This show is part of the RetroZap.com podcast network.
This is Warp Trails, a Star Trek Discovery podcast, a RetroZap podcast network exclusive.
Welcome to Warp Trails, the RetroZap podcast network show devoted to Star Trek. I'm your host, Dennis Keithley, and with me is my wife and co-host, Beth.
Hello, everybody.
Tonight, we are continuing our coverage of Season 2 of Discovery with the discussion of the most recent episode, which is Light and Shadow. So thanks for coming back after that debate we had over the Prime Directive last week. Before we do that, we have a little Star Trek Discovery news to go over. So, Beth, what have we learned?
We have learned that Discovery has been renewed for a third season. Ta-da!
Yeah, we don't know exactly what the subscribers' numbers are, but the press release that came out about it said that, you know, it's been a phenomenal success for CBS All Access. So they've picked it up for a third season after just six episodes. So fantastic.
Yes, I think that's very good news. I'm looking forward to more Discovery.
Yeah, of course, we have no details on what's going to happen in that third season and who the entire cast will be, especially where it comes to Captain.
That is true.
I think Pike is going to feature prominently in tonight's episode, especially with the conclusion of this episode. But
yes,
this, just a reminder, Warp Trails is a full spoiler discussion of Discovery. So if you haven't seen Light and Shadows yet, which is episode 7 of season 2, like I said earlier, then, you know, hit pause, go watch it, and we'll be here when you get back. And if you are still here, then, well, we are assuming that you are accepting the possibility of spoilers. So this episode really has two storylines that are going on, and they mix them up throughout the entire hour.
Right.
Of the episode. But I think for sake of clarity, we're going to split them into two discussions.
Yes.
The first involves Michael Burnham returning to Vulcan in her quest to find Spock. The second involves Captain Pike, Ash Tyler, and Stamets, and the rest of the crew dealing with a temporal rift. Yes. But we'll start with the search for Spock. Haha. See what I did there?
We had to get that in.
Yes. First. So Michael is leaving for Vulcan, and the beginning of the episode shows her packing her bag.
Which is a really cool duffel bag with her name on it. I don't know that I need another bag, but if I wanted a Discovery prop.
I think that's the first I've ever heard you say you didn't know you needed another bag.
But that would be a cool, if I could have, that's one of, there's several Discovery props I would want. And that's,
I wouldn't be surprised if that was available. I don't know if you get them, but I get emails from CBS All Access and Star Trek every week promoting what's on sale in the Discovery store.
Oh, that disco shirt was on, what, 12 seconds after the show aired?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And that was just a crazy demand for that one. But so she meets with Pike on her way out, and they basically agree that they need to find Spock before Starfleet in Section 31 does.
Yeah.
And just my pet peeve, there is way too much dialogue in this episode that's said in a whisper, and you can't have any other noise in the house when they're doing that. And so they're having this conversation about how they need to go find Spock before Section 31. It's like, stop whispering. You're in the middle of the hall. If it was that secret of conversation, have it in Pike's ready room or have it on the lift or whatever.
The assumption, I mean, I understand that Spock is a fugitive, but the assumption of like Section 31 spies reporting that Burnham might do something without, I don't know. That was kind of, I agree with you about the whispering, but it was just sort of interesting that there seemed to be a, like, that Burnham's trip needed to be secret.
Yeah. Well, there it is. So Burnham heads to Vulcan on a Starfleet transport or shuttle.
Yep.
And wow, talk about some incredible special effects. Vulcan looks amazing. You remind me. I mean, I'm trying to think back to when we've seen Vulcan in other Star Trek formats. And in J.J. Abrams' reboot, we get a bit of Vulcan. And, well, we got a lot of Vulcan because the planet gets destroyed.
Yeah.
But even then, it's much more of a wasteland-looking type of a place.
Well, it's almost always a desert planet.
Right. But it's raining here. Yeah. But the buildings, the ships that are flying around, the traffic, it looked incredible. I mean, I don't know how much it cost to produce that very brief scene, but you wouldn't have got that on a network television show at all.
No, it made you want to go to Vulcan.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always wanted to go to Vulcan, but.
Right. So, you know, she signals, she gets a hail from from the Vulcan traffic control, air traffic control, asking her to identify herself. She does as Commander Michael Burnham, and she states her purposes she's asked for permission rather to land at Sarek's place, and that's, you know, this is a personal visit, not official Starfleet business.
Well, that was the actually interesting thing that I wanted to point out, because she says she's here as a daughter.
Yeah.
She doesn't actually confirm that she's here on personal or professional business.
Yeah, I think saying your daughter that would be.
But if you know that the daughter is Starfleet, because anyway.
Well, okay. But when she gets to Sarek's house, she finds him meditating. It's the Takmar, is what Amanda tells us, and it's designed to bring lost souls back home. Which Vulcan mysticism is always fascinating me, because I guess this is a telepathic or psionic type of ability that they must have. Yeah. And this type of thing, again, it just doesn't seem to pair with logic so much. It seems almost wizard-like, I guess, but it works for them. And there is some consternation and surprise there that it's not working for Sarek.
Right. Michael takes it as a real that's it should be working for Sarek, and that it is not, says much more about the situation than it does about Sarek.
Right, because he is one of the most ordered, logical minds, or something like that, how she puts it. But it becomes pretty apparent pretty quickly that Amanda knows where Spock is and why Sarek can't reach him with this technique. But, you know, the lead up to that conversation is that Burnham says that Spock's shuttle was found in the Mataara sector, which was interesting because that's where Spock dies.
Right.
In The Wrath of Khan. So it's not the first time he's been there when we get to that movie in the timeline. But Amanda's clearly, she gives Michael a fairly warm welcome, but she's still mad at him after the last time they saw each other. And, you know, Michael kind of ferrets this whole thing out, which is that, you know, you've told me the truth your entire life. That's how I know you're lying now. And Amanda's fidgeting. I mean, all the signs are there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even want to go as far as to say she's trying. She just very quickly changes tunes from going from, I don't know where he is. I haven't seen him. He's not the way I wouldn't tell you even if I did. He's changed. It's like, yeah. Okay, well then.
Well, she says she's unwilling to turn Spock over to face trial for murders he didn't commit.
Which is fair.
So did she know where he was when she came to find Burnham on the Discovery a couple episodes ago?
I don't know. She says later when they're in the temple, she says he's been there. He's been like this for 2 days.
Okay.
So I'm going to assume no.
Yeah, I guess not. But, well, yeah. And I'm just curious how he even got to the planet undetected. But so eventually, yeah. So as you were just alluding to, Amanda leads Michael to a cave where they, you know, they had to take a shuttle to get there. And when they get there, we finally, 7 episodes in the season, get to meet Spock, as played by Ethan Peck.
Mm-hmm.
He's not in a good way. He's very shaggy at the moment.
Yeah.
He's wandering around muttering, the doctrines of logic?
Mm-hmm.
And he's carving in pictures of the Red Angel and a number, which is 841947,
yep,
on the wall, over and over and over again. So, you know, again, not exactly how I expected to encounter him for the first time, but, you know, they've been alluding to him having a mental, I guess that's it. I thought these reports of him having a mental breakdown were Starfleet and Section 31's cover, that there was some sort of a cover up. I was not expecting that to be a literal truth.
Okay.
I guess that's fair.
Okay.
And it turns out that this cave that Spock is in has got, Katra stones, which is what kept Sarek from reaching him using that technique that he was using. So, but Sarek eventually finds them in this cave, and then there's a big disagreement. There's a lot of things that happen in this scene and when Michael first gets to Vulcan that shed an awful lot of light on this family.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found interesting was that Burnham is, they go back, they flash back to when they're children, mm-hmm. and Michael is trying to do the Vulcan salute, live long yeah. and prosper, and she can't get her fingers to do it. She's giggling about it. Spock says, you know, you're not embarrassed by your failure. What does he say? You know, it's like the, you know, you're laughing about your failure, which right. he doesn't understand. And, you know, Spock says, emotions confuse me. And Burnham says, yeah. But then he helps her make that salute.
Yeah.
I got the feeling from the very first episode of the season, they didn't like each other as kids. Because when she showed up, he slammed the door in her face.
He did. Yeah, I'm assuming that just over time, things change. I mean, by the time of that clip, Michael has that Vulcan haircut. So I'm assuming yeah. some time has changed. Michael later in the episode calls Spock, you know, extremely curious. And it could be that just... I tend to believe that Spock's curiosity overwhelmed him and made him interact with her.
Yeah. There was some very different scenes when they would flash back to Spock and Michael as children in this episode that had a very different tone from the beginning. Up until now, I got the distinct impression that they were standoffish as siblings, as kids. But, and then, which made the whole Burnham so desperately wanting to help this brother that she had so much affection for, just didn't, there was kind of disconnect, I think, for me over the course of the season.
Right.
But now looking back on it, you know, there was the scenes of Amanda reading Alice in Wonderland to Michael. And earlier in the season, Spock was at the doorway and he was scowling mm-hmm. at them. At this one, he's standing in the door, but this time he grins at her.
He's smiling. Yeah.
So I don't know if that is a change in course, because I kind of feel like some of the storylines have changed over the course of the season. They've maybe tweaked them after they've written and filmed an episode or something, but this is, or maybe this one was intentional, but it is a different tone to the relationship than what we were given earlier in the season.
I completely agree. I don't know how much of it is supposed to be the evolution that we're watching, the evolution of the relationship, which is mm-hmm. to, you know, so that we understand that there, it started out bad and then it got good and then it got bad again. Yeah. Or perhaps it never really was bad or it never was good and we're just sort of seeing people's incorrect memories. I don't know.
So we learned some really interesting things about Spock as a child and why it was Amanda was reading Alice in Wonderland to him.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to cover that?
As much as I can, it is sort of spread out. So Spock has dyslexia? Is that what's your takeaway?
Or yeah,
he has a learning disability.
The Vulcans referred to it as Latak Tirai.
Right.
And Amanda,
Leland calls it dyslexia.
Later. Right. I think because Amanda says that this was a learning disability that he inherited from his mother. So right. It would be, on Earth, it's dyslexia. The Vulcans had this other term for it, this right. Latak Tirai. I don't know if that's just Vulcan for dyslexia, but it is a condition that Sarek believed that could be, what do they call it? The Vulcan school, the Vulcan.
The learning center.
Was the learning
fixed
center.
Fixed in the learning center.
It could be fixed in the learning center. And Amanda completely disagreed with that.
Right. That Spock had no support. So he had these human difficulties and the learning center had no interest in supporting a Vulcan with human, you know, human frailties. And so she read Alice in Wonderland to him so that he could learn how to live in a chaotic world.
Right. And there's a key phrase there where up is down and left is right.
Yes. That becomes important later. Mirror images and things not being what they seem. You're right. Very important. Remember yeah. that. Put a pin in it.
So, again, there's this ongoing disagreement between Amanda and Sarek.
It seems like I really liked this scene. I mean, not because uh-huh. the parents are fighting, but the way the two actors did this, there was very much an element of arguments that they've had before. And it's not like that they're pulling them back to be, you know, 30 years ago, you did that horrible thing to me and I hate right. you. It's that, like, the this is where this argument gets us every single time.
Yeah, it seemed tense, but respectful. It seemed like they were trying to use logic, but at the same time, emotion was tugging at this whole thing at right. the from the perimeter.
It's very much how I would think a Vulcan pair would fight.
Right. And then Amanda's telling Burnham that I am not going to turn over Spock. I am going to use diplomatic immunity to protect him and keep him here.
Mm-hmm.
And when Sarek shows, that's when Sarek walks in and says, not if the diplomat objects.
Well, and the diplomat objects not because he thinks Spock needs to face charges for his crimes, but because he and Burnham both believe, and I agree, Spock needs medical attention like now.
Mm-hmm. Hard to disagree with that. But Amanda really believe her fear is that if Spock is turned over to the authorities, then he's not going to get a fair shake. They aren't going to try and heal him. They're going to go after him for what he knows about the Red Angel, and that ultimately, you know, and that these murder charges are trumped up.
And she also seems to think, and she could be right, but I felt that she was grasping at straws, was that one of the reasons why Spock keeps just repeating the laws of logic is because he's attempting to ground himself from whatever he saw.
And then in the middle of that conversation, when he's doing that, he switches over to Alice in Wonderland, reciting right, that.
She mentions it.
Yeah.
And then he starts quoting it. So Spock's just aware enough of what's going on around him.
And I love that Michael was like reciting mouthing the lines as he was saying them as mm-hmm. well, that she had memorized it. This was such a good scene. It was a little hard to keep up with the first time I watched it. But then the second time I watched it, it was just beautiful that, you know, there's this really complicated family dynamic that was going on, and they all really did care about each other, but
really
they had this
family, yeah.
really, they had a really strong disagreement about what needed to be done to help a member of the family.
For sure.
And so, you know, at the end, you know, this argument comes down to Amanda saying, you've never respected humanity. Sarek says that can't possibly be the case because otherwise would have married a Vulcan.
Yep.
And then, you know, they get to the point that, you know, she is his wife, not his subordinate. So she doesn't have to blindly follow along. And that was her rejection of his point of logic. You know, he said, you know, so husband, try again.
Right.
And then, you know, he makes the argument that Spock does need help. The only people that can give him this help is Section 31. And this is going to put Burnham's career in jeopardy. And then he turns around to Amanda and an excellently delivered line. He says, I couldn't bear to lose both of our children in the same day.
Yeah.
And it's that he's trying so hard to choke back the emotion.
Right.
But he can't. I mean, it comes, you know, it is such a facade. I mean, he put up something, you know, I can't remember who plays Sarek, but he put up this incredible facade, but it crumbles there in a second. And it was a beautiful piece of acting.
It was beautiful. And
they really need, Discovery, if nothing else, needs to be commended on the acting this season.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Everyone has done such a fantastic job. It's, you know, it's the classic Star Trek thing where all the actors are learning their parts in that first season, and then they blossom in the second and third into their roles.
And what I fundamentally like about Sarek is, you know, we know that Spock and Sarek had a very contentious, conflicted relationship. And while we watch this episode and understand that Sarek loves his son, and we believe him,
mm-hmm.
there is also just enough seeds that are laid over the course of the conversation where you go, yeah, but I can see from Spock's point of view
right.
that you guys had a very contentious, complicated relationship.
And we can't forget all the complications that we learned about during the first season, which
yeah,
was
sure.
that Sarek could only get one of his children to the Vulcan Expeditionary Force.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose Spock, who then rejected it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that made tension between Spock and Sarek. And then there was tension between Michael and Sarek when she discovered this.
Yep.
And he tried so hard to block her out of it when he got injured on that shuttle.
Yeah.
Because the logic extremist blew himself up,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then Burnham was trying to find him using these techniques, and he kept throwing her out because he didn't want her to discover this truth. And so I don't know. It's been I didn't think last season that I would appreciate this relationship as much as I've come to. And how complicated it is, as in it's been this season. But, okay, so we dwelled there for quite a while. Let's move the story a little bit along. So this ends with Michael taking Spock to Leyland's ship.
Yep.
So he's going to Section 31. And we get plenty more of Philippa Georgiou.
Yes.
Thank goodness. And so as you know, Spock is in a room waiting for Michael to show up, and he's unconscious and still kind of reciting the doctrines of logic. And this gives Michael and Georgiou an opportunity to have a little chat on the way to that room. And I can't remember exactly everything that goes down in there, but you know, the end was the kind of the punchline of the whole conversation is that Georgiou, you know, Burnham says, you know, did you murder your
mother? Yes. Yeah.
And to which Georgiou responds, it was all a blur.
Yeah.
It was kind of hard line to hear. We had to listen to it a half dozen times before we got it. But again, she's just, Michelle Yeoh is so good.
She's just amazingly good at it and having such a good time. Her show cannot come fast enough.
Right. And so Leyland is really laying it on thick with being friendly and how much they're going to work to help Spock, but Burnham can't stay on the ship because she's not authorized. So she should go on ahead to Starbase 23 and get some rest. And on her way out of that room, Georgiou rushes up to her and says, I've knocked out the monitors for 60 seconds. The machines treating Spock are not there to help him. They're going to rip those memories out of his head.
Right.
You need to rescue your brother, which is good for you. And it makes Leland look bad, which is good for me.
Yeah. Which, you know, it's funny because Leland does this whole thing. He promises that Spock will get care. He will get justice. Everything will be fine. And I don't trust Leland, but I don't distrust Leland. And then...
Oh, I completely don't trust him.
Well, I mean, you know, a minute later, the Emperor, who has basically proven that she is totally unreliable and all... Well, it goes back to what I said about she's becoming more and more like Jack Sparrow. I could trust that...
Yeah, she's dishonest. You can trust her to be dishonest. Yeah.
But not that I think she's lying to Burnham. I think she wants Burnham to be part of the plan. And I think the point that she makes, that she, to some extent, knows Burnham better than Burnham knows herself, is not totally inaccurate.
Right. I agree. But so basically, you know, they have 60 seconds to have this conversation and make their plan. And so Georgiou says, you're going to hit me. And so and then before she lays this whole thing out. So with 10 seconds to go, Burnham just punches her in the chest, which catches Georgiou completely by surprise. She's like, good start. I had to make it look good.
And well, so, and to some extent, I mean, Burnham enjoyed punching her.
Oh, gosh, yes. Stop.
However, that being said, you don't want the cameras to come back on, there be a pause, right, and then there's a punch. So if the fight has already started by the time the camera comes back on, you can pretty much safely assume that most of the fight's been going on while the camera's
completely
off.
Agree with you. It was the perfect strategic thing to do. But how much did she enjoy catching Georgiou off guard?
Loved it.
It was not just the hitting her. It was the catching her off guard. Oh, because yes. Georgiou's been doing that to her this entire season.
Oh, for sure. And most of last season.
Yeah. And so she hits her 10 seconds. And then they have an epic fight. It is just awesome. It's, I really enjoyed the fight between Georgiou and Lorca at the end of last season. But this was really good.
It was really well choreographed. It was really, I like how the camera work moved around so that while they're in this fairly small hallway, there's not a sense of them being cramped. I mean, they really get extension on those kicks.
Yeah. But so the whole thing works, and there's a monitor that breaks because Burnham hits Georgiou so hard, her head smacks back into it. And then Michael takes her Georgiou's blaster and goes to get Spock and drags him off to a shuttle. They then escape to an asteroid field. There's a bunch of Section 31 ships that are flying around looking for them, and then they can't find them, so they leave.
Right.
You know, Michael is kind of has a mini, I don't want to call it a breakdown, but her emotion overcomes her, and she's hugging Spock and, you know, saying, you know, you must have been so lonely with this condition that you had. And, you know, it's, you know, you're on both sides of the looking glass. And so she's thinking about this through the lens of Alice in Wonderland when she realizes that he likely was reciting these numbers that he was reciting in the beginning backwards. And so she tells the computer to look those up, and it comes back with the coordinates for the planet Talos 4.
Bum, bum, bum.
So I knew that that was something, but didn't realize what it was until we saw the preview for next week's episode.
Okay.
You understand it better than me, so I'd like you to explain it.
Okay. Talos 4 is the system that Pike is, it's a planet of telepaths, super smart beings. Probably if you had asked me to pick a species to go up against the Red Angel, I would have gotten to them. because they basically can create universes, you know, within the mind. They were featured prominently in The Cage.
From the original series.
Which is the original series unaired first episode that got turned into The Menagerie, which was an episode that featured Pike and that race.
The research I did into that reference suggested that their world had become unlivable because of a nuclear holocaust type situation, and that they created these worlds using their psionic telepathic type powers.
Yeah.
And then it was forbidden for people in the Federation to go there. But Pike ultimately ends up there after he becomes permanently disabled and confined to a wheelchair because he was involved in some sort of an accident.
Yes.
And he wanted to go there because they could use their powers and give him the illusion of living in a world where he wasn't disabled.
That is all correct.
And so, you know, that's interesting because, you know, we have Pike now, and we're going to the world that ultimately, you know, at some point we're going to be going to the world that is his destiny.
Well, they haven't been subtle with the Cage Easter eggs.
Yeah. So, you know, that's coming up. You know, the aftermath of all this for Section 31, and we still have an entire storyline to go, is that Georgiou, you know, she seems to be following a very Terran Empire, Mirror Universe-like approach to her assignment in Section 31.
Mm-hmm.
She is talking with Leyland, you know, and she sells the ruse that Burnham had overpowered her. And then she reminds Leyland that she needs her to keep Burnham from discovering the truth, which is...
Apparently Leland is responsible for Burnham's parents' death.
Yeah. We don't know exactly how that came out. Now, was that the reference that she made, in the prior episode when she said something like, you know, if
the ambassador, firewall,
if you could look behind your firewall, you'd find the evidence that was needed that, you know, you had that ambassador killed.
I had gotten the impression that that was something else that she found.
I guess it could be. There could be. But, he's Section 31, so he probably has a lot of dirty secrets. But yeah. And then she goes so far as to say that, you know, hey, you know, mind your manners because you aren't calling the shots anymore.
Right.
So she's moved in. She's making her power play. All right. So that does it for the first part of this episode. We have this entire other story as, you know, Michael is left to go to Vulcan, and Discovery is still at Kaminar after they've helped the Kelpians out. And they are there to kind of analyze the decay of some particles to see if they can try and figure out from how far in the future the Red Angel might have been.
Yes.
When Tilly discovers, this is technobabble and, you know, and pseudoscience type things about some ridiculous number of microns, you know, with whatever, like the density of a supernova that's building up. And she has a funny little scene where she, you know, it's a freaking huge or something like that. And Saru gets on her for swearing on the bridge. And so she stutters over it. But then Pike kind of puts her at ease by saying, you know, let's take our time and seeing this freaking amazing situation. But then a space fisher emerges and Discovery's got to deal with this.
Yes.
So they are going, they're going to launch a probe, but again, there's a lot of going back and forth. So forgive me if I don't get quite all the details right. They aren't in a position to do so because of the gravity and the radiation coming out of this fissure.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to, you know, Pike says, we're going to take a shuttle. We'll get closer. We'll launch the probe from there. And I just happen to be the best suited person on this ship to fly the shuttle because my first job in Starfleet was as a test pilot for these things. Meanwhile, Ash has come in and he's a little too big for his britches. He demands to know where Burnham is. And Pike says, personal leave. Where'd she goes? It's personal leave. Kind of puts in its place. So that's the kind of the ongoing theme of this part of the story is this distrust between Pike and Ash.
Yes.
So I don't know. What did you think about Ash in all this?
I think Ash is overstepping his bounds. I think he also, while as a member of Section 31, I think he was right that if hunting down Spock, which is part of what Section 31 is doing, is the reason why Burnham left. Maybe Ash should have been told. I also kind of wonder how much their personal history is playing into Burnham did something and I don't know about it. Not like a jealousy factor, but just sort of like an abnormally high interest in what she is doing.
Yeah, you're right. He does have a point that if she did leave and it has something to do with finding Spock, then, you know, Section 31 and Discovery have been given the joint responsibility of finding him. He should have been told. But he pulls off his badge and throws it at Pike.
Yeah.
You know, like...
Who says the chair outranks the bed.
Yeah, I love that. And then he throws it back at her. And this is when the this space fish, which is a temporal rift, until he has a great line. It's like when you put time in front of anything, it makes it cooler.
Yes.
That's when it starts interfering things, because they're up near the viewer screen, start talking, and they turn around and, you know, Tilly says, you know, what freaking is that? You know, or, I can't remember exactly the line, but she uses freaking a lot in this episode. And it is a replay of Pike and Ash's confrontation there at the captain's chair.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see that there's a whole bunch of temporal problems going on. The computers are having a difficulty with this that they're not suited for. It was a little strange that Saru and them just kind of like, oh, the computers have a problem when there's temporal issues going on. Like, you know, oh, it's one of those crazy temporal issues. Like, it happens all the time, you know.
It is Star Trek. I mean, it is Star Trek.
But I think that's missing the point, though, which is that time travel should not be that common occurrence.
That is
everybody
true.
On the bridge is just kind of like, oh, it's a time issue. Our computer's going to be on the fritz.
Well, not only that, but if it's such a normal thing, why haven't they fixed the computers?
Yeah, but, you know, well, and everyone else seems oblivious to everything else that's happened. I guess that's just kind of my criticism here. I mean, granted, you know, they just dealt with Mud attacking their ship last season, and so these temporal issues are not completely out of the question, but it's not like everyone understood how that happened or what the solution was.
Right.
That was a very scientific thing that was left to Stamets, who has the tardigrade DNA floating around in him that, you know, helped solve that. And Saru ends up using that to his advantage, that, you know, Stamets has got this tardigrade DNA. He can, you know, he should be able to see through this problem.
Yes, he has a unique relationship with time.
All right. So on the shuttle, Pike and Tyler are headed towards the rift. They're launching the probe and they're not getting along.
Right. This is so Trek.
Yeah, you know, Tyler keeps pressing this whole thing that you're making all these bad decisions because you missed out on the war, and now you're trying to prove something by getting into all this danger. It is an incredibly ridiculous amount of back talk.
And Pike finally shuts him down, which is what I have wanted Pike to do several times over the last couple of episodes, is just, I am the captain, and I'm going to assert my leadership, and... He finally did it and basically said, I mean, this was with Pike says he wants to burn some of the plasma to leave it as a marker. And right. Ash basically says, no, I won't let you.
Yeah, it's crazy maneuver. We can't burn fuel.
Right. And Pike basically says, you do it or I'm going to throw you back and I'm going to throw you in the brig. And you can think about risk while you wait for a court martial.
Yeah.
And
I really like that, too.
I nearly applauded the first time I heard it and enjoyed it at least as much the second time.
Yeah, you know, again, to our earlier point, Ash isn't necessarily wrong, but he's just incredibly insubordinate about the whole thing.
You can be right and be acting a fool.
Yeah, he's very arrogant about this. This whole assignment to Section 31, you know, I get it. He doesn't have control over the fact that he's got Valk is now part of him. And in fact, there's a conversation about that. They get up. There's a very cool scene before they get in the shuttle where they're on the turbo lift, or what do they call them? The lift in Discovery, and you kind of see it going through the ship, and it's like
that
all
was
these.
Cool.
It was kind of cool. I didn't quite get how that worked within the framework of the ship, but regardless, when they get off, you know, this is one of the first times Ash throws it into Pike's face about the whole fact that, you know, you sat out the Klingon War, you know, that war is over. And Pike says, it's not that, you know, you have this Klingon, it's that you killed a member of this crew.
Right. It's not that Valk is a Klingon, it's that Valk is a murderer.
Right. And he's inside you. And so Ash says, well, okay, he's here and we can't get rid of him. He keeps popping up. To which Pike says, I completely relate to that.
Right.
It's a really snappy dialogue in this, especially Anson Mount's doing an awesome job as Pike.
He really is.
And they've given him a lot of good material to work with. It is he's not quite the roguish cowboy type figure that Kirk was.
No, but you could see how, and I think I said this to you, you can kind of see how Pike and Kirk are of the same age and the same time where that kind of like, not snark, but kind of like charming wit and little digs was...
They're quick-witted.
Yeah, was a desired trait. Mm-hmm. And they have both worked to have it. But, you know, you think about how difficult it would be to follow in shoes of, you know, the incredible actor we had last season in the captain's chair. And yeah.
Jason Isaacs, yeah.
Done a great job.
Yeah. They've been having problems on the shuttle. You know, they're one, they're not getting along. Two, Pike looks, turns around. You know, he knows that they are seeing events that are happening in the present, the past, and the future, like experiencing them all at the same time.
Yep.
Tilly describes it as that time in this rift is like going through a blender. It's not like a stream. It's not linear. It's like time's been chopped up in a blender. And when he turns around and point looks at the back of the shuttle, he sees himself shooting Ash.
Yes.
And it's just kind of like, and he looks over there. Ash hasn't seen it, so he doesn't say anything.
It's the best, like,
I'm going to keep that card in my sleeve. Yeah. And so, you know, they're having this disagreement, and then they run into the probe that they've already launched.
Yes.
And not only that, the probe is angry.
It's upgraded and angry. I called it Space Squid.
Yeah, you called it Space Squid.
Doc Ock's Space Probe, which is also, I think, totally accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, within the realm of what it looks like.
Well, they analyze it and determine that it is, based on like the breakdown of the fusion reactor or something like that, that it's aged 500 years.
Yes.
So it went into this temporal rift 500 into the future, someone upgraded and sent it back to attack them, is what they figure out. And the thing sprouts tentacles and starts attacking the shuttle.
Yep.
A couple of them pierce the hull.
Yep.
And start attacking them. The one tentacle ends up wrapping around Ash, and that is the scene that Pike actually saw. He didn't see the tentacle.
Right.
Which probably means that somehow that was shielded from the temporal thing. Well, the they didn't really get into that.
Perfect anyway.
So yeah, it was kind of a blurry thing, but you couldn't see it. But what Pike was shooting the tentacle that was wrapped around Ash.
Yep.
And while this is going on, Stamets is finally brought into the problem on Discovery because he has the tardigrade DNA that Sara figures that he could be useful. And he does see what's going on. So he convinces Tilly that he can plot the coordinates using these plasma bursts. Mm-hmm. That Ash and Pike were arguing about to figure out where that is, you know, after just having told how complicated this was, you know, something about the, you know, it's like trying to catch a grain of sand in a hurricane using tweezers.
Yeah.
Again, a lot more science babble, techno babble going on here. It doesn't, the solution here doesn't seem as grounded in any type of science, like, you know, the thermodynamics thing we had when they were going to get Tilly out of the mycelial network a couple episodes ago.
Yeah.
This one seems just a bit more convenient to throw some words around that don't necessarily mean anything to come up with a solution. It's the solution's based more in the science fiction than it is any real science.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so he's figured out where they are and he beams aboard their ship and then he's able to get them into a position where Discovery can beam them back.
And this was interesting. Because Tilly basically says they're 1 minute away from being, like, sucked out forever. And I was like, y'all don't have time for this. But they made a point when Stamets beams onto the ship, he says that basically he's come back 10 minutes in time so that he can get out of the shuttle. I thought that was because Discovery's not always gotten those catches where, like, pacing and time and y'all are dead because y'all stood around talking.
Yeah.
This was one time where they actually wrote it into the script.
Yeah, we got 1 minute, 3 minutes later, 20 seconds left.
You know, right, like, we're all about to die. No, we have to finish the speech.
Yeah.
But this time they did not. I was very pleased.
And it'd be remiss if we didn't address the fact that he gave Tilly this great little pep talk at the transporter because she's like, I can't beam you out there in this temporal rift. You know, I don't know where it is. And he's like, but I know where it is. I have the tardigrade DNA and there's no one I trust more than you. Right.
Trust the math. So trust the math, yourself.
Trust yourself and do it. And so she does.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gets there. He helps them figure out how to get out. Discovery gets a lock on them. Pike sets the self-destruct because after they shot the tentacle, part of it launched into the computer and began scanning the database, looking for something we don't know what.
Yeah, which seems odd that something 500 years in the future would want to look
I'm guessing like lost records.
Books. Yeah.
At some point. And, but that's not the end of it. So the shuttle blows up. But again, because we have all this time distortion going on back on Discovery, they are getting ready. You know, they have to leave. They have to go to warp. But Lieutenant Commander Arium, who we're not sure if it was an alien, an augmented human, cyborg looking member of the crew.
Yes.
She's looking at one of these monitors, and all of a sudden there's these flash, these three lights, and they seem to have hacked her.
Right, because she tries to lock, what she is attempting to do is lock the space squid out of the system, and in the process of doing that, to your point, gets hacked herself.
Right, and so that's kind of a dangling plot thread that I'm sure will come up in a future episode. So, you know, we've got that going on. They go to warp right before there's supposed to be a time tsunami. And then Tilly says, yeah, this is one of those times when adding time at the beginning doesn't make it any cooler.
It sounds much worse than it, or it sounds horrible.
Yeah. So they go to warp and they avoid the time tsunami. I guess my question is what about, the Kelpians?
The planet?
Yeah.
Yeah. I also am wondering about the planet.
I mean, is it just not reaching the planet? Was it just aimed at Discovery?
Bouncing off the atmosphere.
I can't help but wonder if this isn't going to be an episode in the future where the Kelpians get launched like 500 years into the future and they become an issue. You know, so they're evolved 500 years beyond where we left them. So they have their own technology, but we'll see. And then we kind of have the come together moment for this part of the storyline where Pike concedes that Ash might be right about his motivation, which was, you know, he's trying to prove something after having been forced to sit out the war.
Right.
And that they can no longer assume and conclude that the Red Angel is there with the best of intentions. They don't know if it's there to start something or for something to finish something.
Right.
Here's my question. I'm wondering if there isn't two sides of this, that the Red Angel is one side and whoever was responsible for the risk was the other side. And we have some sort of a temporal war going on.
That happened in Enterprise.
Yeah, so thank you. Just the word right out of my mouth. And if it is, but interesting, I guess. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about them recycling that type of thing.
It could be interesting. I am willing to give them a few episodes to figure out if this is... I'm willing to watch a couple episodes before I say, oh no, not a temporal war.
Right.
But I did think... oh, okay, we're going to do this again, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And then we get the big teaser for next week when Burnham and Spock get to Talos IV and everything that happens there. And, you know, looks awesome, looks confusing, looks terrifying with some of the stuff we saw there. But that is another episode.
Well, and I'm hoping they get this was another episode where the pacing got a little weird at the end. It was almost...
there was too much plot for 1 hour in this episode, I think would be my big criticism.
Well, and it was just another, like, Stamets will save everyone. And I love Stamets. I'm on board with him saving everybody, but he can't save everybody every week.
Yeah, I you know, it's, I agree. I like the fact that everyone's getting used in each one of the episodes making an appearance. I like the fact that Mr. Reese on the bridge got some key scenes helping figure, you know, when he was the one that figured out the whole plasma discharge thing that was going on, and you know, Saru gave him a compliment. You know, Detmer's been getting more of a presence, gets more lines every episode. The crew, the bridge crew, and you know, the communications officer, I can't remember that gentleman's name. You know, but they're all getting more lines, they're getting more speaking roles, they get to be more active parts of the solution.
And this was one of the episodes where the crew, you know, when Saru said it's gone from research to rescue, the crew was solving the problem.
Yeah.
It wasn't let's access the probe and see what the probe knows. And then let's, you know.
Yeah, they didn't go to the orb.
They didn't go to the orb.
They didn't rely on that. So that's going to be kind of a convenient.
But, you know, okay. I can live with that if they're not going to it to every single episode.
But they may not. Yeah, I mean, I guess the orb wouldn't have known about this temporal rift because it's a brand new thing. It hasn't been around for 10,000 years, but be that as it may. So what was your overall impression?
You know, I liked Saru acting more like Saru. I don't need him scared all the time. I like confident Saru when he seems to have his feelings and when he is being the leader that I know he can be. So he was very much in that episode. The Captain Saru that I really like was very much on display, and I enjoyed that quite a lot. This is, to me, a pretty decent bridging episode of like, so we talked about all this stuff and we set all this stuff up for you, and now we're going to sort of move on. We see Spock, but is Spock really a character in this episode, or is he pretty much a prop that Burnham has to... I feel like we technically saw Spock, but we have not actually...
Well, we didn't technically see Spock. We actually saw Spock.
Okay, Spock but he was technically not... in this episode...
But he was not, that's illogical, Captain Spock. It was...
He was not even...
He was mumbling idiot Spock.
He was not coherent Spock.
Right. No, I understand what you're saying. I agree, but I like the fact that we actually have him now.
Yeah.
How many episodes are we going to have to deal with this is my question.
I don't know. And I liked his voice. Like, the voice in the cave sounds... It sounded vaguely familiar.
There was a couple things that he said that I heard Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah,
talking.
But it didn't sound
much
like...
more than I ever did with Zachary Quinto playing Spock in the Abrams movies.
Yeah, and it didn't sound like an impression. It sounded just like maybe they got lucky with the casting.
Yeah, it was just a couple of lines that he delivered. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of that muttering didn't sound like the Spock that we know at all. But
but
there were a few lines when he was slightly more coherent and you could understand what he was saying that I said, oh, there he is.
Yeah,
the
timing.
You could see it. I am hoping we get several episodes with Spock, you know, the real Spock, not this character who's having a mental breakdown. And if we don't, that's going to be incredibly disappointing because that's one of the selling points of this season, that it has Spock in it.
Right.
And so let's at least do us that bit of fan service. Give us Spock at some point.
But I liked Pike standing up for himself.
Mm-hmm.
I did like the family dynamic. We talked about that, but I did like the family dynamic. This is one of those episodes that I feel like after we've seen the season and I go back and I binge the whole thing,
uh-huh.
that this will be a nice, like, oh, yay, this is that setup episode that I like.
Right. This is not one of the episodes that you just play by itself. Because neither part of it is a contained episode, is you know, a story in isolation. If you go back to New Eden, you had a story there. I mean, you know... Granted, the red signal is what got them there, but there is a story about, you know, the human civilization that's been abandoned on some other world for 300 years and whether or not the Prime Directive applies. That whole debate that you and I had last week.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the finding the Federation crew out on an asteroid somewhere and how you're going to rescue them. It's not one of those types of episodes. The two stories here are interesting. They had a... introduction, the rising action, a climax, falling action,
right.
The whole, they had the story elements, but they don't mean much outside of the larger story. And
no,
so your description of it being a bridge episode, I think is right on. That being said, I thought this episode was awesome.
It was fun.
Great special effects, great action. The pacing got a little fast at points. I agree with you there.
I feel like they ran out. They were like, oh crud, which I find interesting about Discovery. Cause I think I felt like one of the reasons they said they were going to the streaming was first of all to get the budget for the special effects, which they're using, mm-hmm. no problem, but also so they didn't have to be quite so beholden to an episode time.
Right.
And I feel like this episode could have benefit from 5 more minutes.
I agree completely.
And there have been several episodes where I'm like, if you could just have given that back half a couple more minutes or taken a few more minutes, maybe not felt the need to fill in the front.
It's a 14-episode season, is my understanding. So we have 7 episodes left.
Yeah.
You could have done another episode or two on this season and, you know, say the episode that dealt with the Klingon homeworld and other things going on, split some of those stories apart, made them longer, given them their own episodes, and made it a 16-week season, and no one would complain.
No.
But that being said, I liked it overall. The special effects are great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I love the Alice in Wonderland tie in to the Spock and Burnham family type of thing. And this is one I'll be happy to watch again. It's minor quibbles overall with what's going on. I like the fact that it is giving us more intrigue with the overarching story of the season. You know, because we now know that, Section 31's in deeper on this than we thought. We know that there's something going on from 500 years in the future that's tying into all this. And Section 31 probably knows what that is. Spock is tied up in this mystery and he's got some vision going forward about all this. And, you know, and it was entertaining. So
I thought it was interesting that the idea of his dyslexia is the reason why he is able to know as much about the Red Angel as he is.
Yeah.
I was like, okay.
All right. Well, that's going to do it then for our discussion of Light and Shadows. We'll be back soon with some more Star Trek discussion. But before we go, Beth, this is the point where you tell everyone where they can find us online.
I will do that then. We can be reached on Twitter at Warp Trails, on Instagram and Facebook at Warp Trails Pod. We can be reached by email at warptrails@retrozap.com. And the RetroZap Podcast Network has its own Discord channel or server.
Server, yeah.
And we have a channel, so we are often floating around there.
Yeah, and there was a smattering discussion today about this episode and some of the things that are coming up with that, which was fun to engage in. There's been some recent discussion in the general discussion room over there on Discord about the Captain Marvel Magic Eye pictures that came out. Have you a chance to see those yet?
No.
From the 90s, remember those? The Magic Eye thing?
I do. Have you seen the... the 90s style website that they did.
Yeah, tomorrow. It's been really great.
Ridiculously awful.
But we've got a lot of conversation going on there and all kinds of aspects of geekdom. There's been a lot of great video game discussion as of late and other things. So even if you don't want to come talk to us, go over to the Discord channel and talk to everybody else. We participate in a lot of the different rooms and we have a good time. But our show is, as Beth was suggesting, part of the RetroZap Podcast Network. You can head over to RetroZap.com for the other great podcasts covering everything from collecting, video games, Dune, Game of Thrones, Star Wars, and a whole lot more. That's where you can find my Star Wars podcast with Dartaxis and Jay Krebs, which is Starship Sabers and Scoundrels. Our theme music is Wasp from Faces by Misha Dixon, which is available on the Free Music Archive. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Live long and prosper, and we'll talk to you next time.
Remember, trust the math, but more importantly, trust yourself.